I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
How lovely.
Yes, how lovely. And I'm so happy that that you reached out to talk, because I have been totally, totally loving your book. And yeah, I've been getting so much out of it. And it really came at a perfect time. I had a miscarriage at the beginning of the year. So I was really looking for something to, it was such a bizarre, I had never, that experience is so intense. And so your book came at like the perfect time to help reestablish a new connection with that part of my body. So on a personal level, it was perfect timing. So I'm glad you reached out.
Oh, I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you. I know. It's such a bizarre thing. I don't know if you've experienced it, but I'm sure that you've worked with plenty of women that have.
It's quite a special kind of loss. It is.
It just seems to me actually like quite a spiritual gift. As a spiritual seeker, after a while, it was kind of nice to see, to be at the precipice of both life and death. It's kind of a cool place to be. I mean, it was devastating, and I've done a lot of work around it, so I'm feeling much better now. I couldn't talk about it before without crying, but now I'm kind of, as a teacher, it's such a potent moment, right? That moment right in between both things.
She's definitely the womb is definitely a place of death, like as much as birth, the same as birth and death happens in there, the same amount. Anyway, I'm glad.
Anyway, so not to jump into that darkness right away, But I'll just tell you a little bit about the podcast. So I started this a couple years ago, and I just wanted to have more conversations. I personally just wanted to have conversations with women who are on the spiritual path, because all my teachers had been men. And so then it just was a really personal thing, and I had the opportunity with Ram Dass's network to do it. And then I had this question in the back of my mind, which was, is the spiritual path different for men than it is for women? And so that's kind of the gist of how the whole thing began and where the conversations are rooted in.
Okay. This is good. I think it's a really, I think it's really good to open up these conversations, because, a lot of women are in the position you're in. So all of their teachers have been men, and there are similarities and there are differences, So, yeah.
And tell me what you think those are.
I think that I always imagine, and I'm talking to you now, this was the last day of a Yoga Nidra teacher training and facilitator course, and it was 29 women and one man, and it was co-taught by myself and Philippe and Julie, so we had a two women and one man teaching team. And I usually give, I see it, there's a geometry to it. So the spiritual path that we're often given as in most wisdom traditions, in yoga and in other traditions, it's almost like, I don't know if you can see, but it's like a triangle that's an upward pointing triangle. That's an ascension model. So the ascension model as a masculine spiritual practice requires effort and endeavor, you know, to get to the top of the mountain where the Shiva is sitting. And that's a very common practice. You ascend, you progress, don't you? You get better at meditation or you get better at asana. And so you ascend. And that's where all the spirit is, somewhere up there, out of the body. Whereas if you think of the triangle down the other way, like in Yoni Mudra, downward pointing triangle, that is like more of the descent of grace. So the descent of grace is a Shakti triangle. So for women as an embodied practice, yeah, is a downward, it's a descent into the wisdom of the earth rather than trying to escape from the body. And so there is a place where those two meet, which is in the heart. You know, the symbol for Anahata Chakra in the esoteric anatomy of yoga is like a Star of David. It has an upward pointing triangle and it has a downward pointing triangle, and they meet in the middle. So you get this ascension to the realm of the spirit, and then you get this descent of grace. And I would say that if you take all of these female siddhis or female superpowers like menstruation and menopause and miscarriage and birth and all of these powers, and these are the opportunities to receive the descent of grace if we have a conscious awareness of them. So for women, have to do a vision quest, like you just wait to bleed. You know, there's visionary capacity in menstruation and in menopause and in the connection with powerful sexual arousal with women. There's so many ways that are fully embodied. Lactation is a siddhi, pregnancy is a siddhi. You know, all of these things are ways that we can experience in an embodied way the power of life moving through us. We don't need to get out of our bodies for that to happen. We just need to pay attention to things that everybody wants you to feel ashamed for.
Right, and not talk about and not have as an experience. And
yeah, it's just it, in certain circles, I move in a lot of yoga circles, things like menstruation and menopause and pregnancy are merely inconveniences instead of highways to like spiritual awareness and deep knowing and wisdom. And so I like to welcome these things. And the difficulty is that we live in a patriarchy which has made most of those things shameful because they don't want anybody to get connected to your own power, because then you're really quite troublesome, because you don't need some priest to show you the way to God, because like you're embodying the visionary powers of life every time you bleed or you have a hot flush or, you know, all of that. Anyway, so it's quite a different way of looking at everything.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, it was. It's been part of the struggle of my own personal life is that I never ascribed to the keep quiet about what was going on with yourself. I've never been a fist pumping feminist, but I've always wanted to just share my own experience. And And in these last few months, I understood why people don't talk, why women have not shared their true experience for many, many years, because it's out there. You know, you're using the word cities, just in the embodied feminine, the cities. I mean, the capacity to hold life and death in the same moment and span through that spiritual breath within your own body and experience, when you try to articulate that, it sounds pretty nuts.
It only sounds nuts to people who don't pay attention.
Right, exactly.
Like if you actually pay attention, what happens to a girl when she starts to bleed, or what happens to a woman when she's become pregnant, or what happens at lactation or menopause or giving birth, you only have to look a little bit with your eyes open to see that the awesome powers of life herself are moving through these bodies. You don't have to look very hard. So it only seems nuts because we're told not to look. We're told to look somewhere else, you know? So.
And why do you think that is? I mean, what do you think it was? Why were we told to look somewhere else? Or what is it that inspires that desire to make us look away from that power?
Well, because if you want to run an empire or establish a Holy Roman Empire or a Catholic Church, you can't have lots of women with their own powerful connection to the divine that you don't have to mediate. You know what I mean? If you want to control power, I mean, I am a fist-pumping feminist. I think there's no point being a feminist unless you're a strident feminist, because all you have to do is open your eyes and you see that every structure that we inhabit, down from capitalist economics to the education system, is designed to disempower people. If you want to run an empire, whether that's a Catholic empire or a Roman empire or some version of the two or U.S. capitalism, basically you want to disempower people. So it's very important that you can't take that power away from women. You can't stop women bleeding. You can't stop them having female orgasms, which are another manifestation of the divine. You can't stop them giving birth or experiencing death within the womb or having menopause. You can't stop women doing that. But what you can do is make them very ashamed about it so that they want to hide that power. It's like, I always use this metaphor. I spend a lot of time training yoga nidra teachers, so I spend a lot of time asleep or in dream. We've just done like 30 yoga nidras en français in French. It was amazing. But what I say is, imagine a world where human was allowed to let anybody else know that they ever went to sleep. Okay? Imagine a world where sleep is shameful, where this natural function is so totally disgusting and abhorrent that you must never tell anyone that you ever feel sleepy, and you must never let anyone see you sleep. And it's a natural human function, and we need to do it. Well, so is menstruation and menopause and all these other things, but we have to behave like none of that happens. So the power and the amazing healing forces of sleep, if we lived in a world where you weren't allowed to sleep, would be something like people would start dying and going crazy. But pretty much that is what we've done with menstruation. I mean, forget about anything else. Forget about the medicalization of the natural birthright of like birth and how it is to have a powerful menopause and all of these things which are now medical problems. They're not. They're initiations into power. And that's why the female experience of the spiritual path is different than the male path, because it's encoded in our DNA. We get cyclical wisdom, and sleep is like that. So just imagine if you had to pretend not to sleep. It's exactly the same kind of craziness, really. You know, so when you said it seems nuts to talk about these things, from where I stand, it seems totally crazy not to.
Well, no, I mean, I mean, personally, I personally feel the same way. But what I was saying, this last experience gave me my first real feeling of I understand why women up until now have not been sharing their experience, because nobody wants to hear it. And for this particular experience of mine, nobody wants to hear it. Nobody wants to know that it's so wild. And so I guess then my question to you, and this is not, I know where your work is focused, but how do you bridge that gap? Is the step just to empower more and more women to have the capacity to recognize these things as cities and to share about them? Or how do you get across the way so that we can all of us benefit and embrace this power?
That, Melanie, is the question. This is the best question to ask. So I've spent like 20 years doing this work, and I've spent my whole life like with feminist perspectives. And what I see is that one very powerful way is woman by woman, womb by womb, like awakening the recognition that the power is within us and that we don't have to feel ashamed of it. So that's one way. And I've been doing that work, and lots of people are doing that work. I work with the people at redschool.net, which is why menstruality consciousness teachers online. They're awesome. Loads of people all over the world. There's the Red Tent movement, and there's a lot of very beautiful, and that's like one woman at a time. And also in circles of women, I think women function as us in our optimal way in circles with other women. And if we separate off from each other and think of this as individual quest, then we miss the point. So I work with circles of women and circles of sharing and circles of community. And so I've worked mostly at the like emotional, physical, and psychic level of each individual woman. So I share practices that help people, help women feel connected to cyclical wisdom. And then they make changes in their lives around that are quite impressive. But I also think that we need legislation around it. So I'm working to bring menstrual policies into schools and workplaces. I do it at a small level, like with my own daughter's school. And I see that at an ecological level, there are very important decisions to be made because of the shame that we have around menstruation, most women who bleed will wrap up blood in some plastic envelope, and it then becomes a toxic biohazard. So part of what, you know, it is, it becomes this is the blood of life. If each woman on earth were to give her blood back to the trees, to the plants, to the earth, would renew the capacity of the earth to be a fun and lovely thing, and we wouldn't have a toxic biohazard. So I'm trying to raise awareness. I've been working for so long at an individual level with circles of women and groups of women, communities of women, and camps, and you know, there's a network of people. But I actually now see there's a call for a global, like legal and environmental responsibility. Women who bleed have a planetary responsibility to make a wise choice about what you do with that blood, you know. And I think that's actually, and it's very difficult to have those conversations because people are so ashamed. So you see the toxic biohazard in the ocean, and most of the plastic that's come around the British coastlines are like plastic tampon applicators and the plastic bits out of the back of panty liners. I can't give an invitation to women: don't put anything plastic near your yoni. Insist on biodegradable, you know, planet-friendly menstrual products, or use reusables, or use a moon cup or a diva cup or some way that you can give the blood back to the earth. Because if we don't, that we continue to pollute.
Right.
We're actually already polluted in ourselves. There's a pollution of shame, and that ends up being an active pollution of the oceans.
Well, so I mean, to your point, there's
fest, and I was mostly talking about sacred activism. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I want to get into that. I know about that part of your thing too, but I want to just kind of jump in on this, which is that through doing that, you're giving the woman even more power because you're connecting her to the power of the earth and the power of that great change. And so this leads me into, you know, what is the foundation of your work is Tantra, right? Your work is rooted in tantric study. So can you speak a little bit about how all of that is Shaktism, how all that is Shaktism and Shaivism and Tantra, and how that all is the foundation of where this comes from spiritually?
Yeah, thank you for this invitation. So, I usually have a little, like a, what would you call it, like a cautionary note, because some people think that Tantra is like neo-Tantra and it's all about sex and orgasm, but actually Tantra literally just means a weaving. It's a weaving of a thread of very powerful teachings that particularly in Shakta Tantra. So this is teachings that are really honoring the power of Shakti, which literally just means energy or power, but it's associated with the Devi, with the gods. So it's an honoring of the sense of the one way that's really important to understand it is that it sees the human body as a microcosm, like that actually within the human body, all the elements exist. So the body itself is considered to be earth. There's a system of philosophy in India called Sankhya, and that's kind of tied in the same structure as there often in the tantras and things like the Yoni Tantra, and they relate to having respect for women and girls. So some of the words that I learned from these scriptures were things like the Yoni Pushpam, which means the flowers of the Yoni, which is the blood, menstrual blood. So there's an honoring for the functions of the human body, not just the female body. But in this system, you see each energy center, each part of the body has an element. Each sense is related to the element. So if we actually, sacralizes the human body, and that we see the human body as a holy place and not separate from, but the same as everything else that's alive, so that when we practice reverence for life and in the world, it's not just like divine life and honoring your deities, but actually honoring the human form as this microcosm. And that's a very powerful, like, positive affirmation of the power of life and the power of women and girls who are can be revered in these tantras. And there's lots of beautiful poems that honor every aspect of the goddess, and many, many stories that have this huge power of the goddess truly revered. It's very beautiful. Yeah, so Yoni Shakti, the book that I wrote, is like the one of the books that I wrote, the biggest one, so is all rooted in that system. And it was most popular in the kind of 10th century in India, but it has much older roots than that. And it has a kind of almost like a continuous presence of reverence for Ma. Ma is the like the mantra of the deep feminine. It's mother. We've just been.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in India, I was with when I traveled to India, I was with a Vedantic teacher, and we went to all the Shiva. We looked at 1,000, you know, Shiva lingams, and then while I was there, I had no idea. Then when I later had been looking on the internet, and I saw the Shakti, the Yoni pujas. I don't know what they're called actually, but the temples that had the
Yoni pujas.
Yeah, the Yoni pujas. My mind was blown. I still can't even imagine the image to see that worshipped the way that the lingam, the symbol of the lingam, you know, is not sexualized in the, it's not a Western sexualization when you're pranam, you know, you're pranaming to the lingam. But when I saw the pictures, I have yet to be to a temple with a yoni, I was just like, how is that not sexual? How do you not have that feeling? Like, how does that not evoke the feeling? It's such a different image. I'm just curious about it. Like, is it just, I'm wondering if that was just my Western programming, or because it was more anatomically representative than the lingams, which are just, you know, kind of rock sticking up, or you get what I'm getting at?
And some of them are like openings to the caves, you know, and but often you rarely see the lingam without some kind of yoni to hold right. It. You know, when you do the pujas with the lingam, there's always a yoni shape to receive.
Correct.
And I think it's this quality of understanding that the power of the strength and the power of this Shakti is in reception. It's in receiving the powers of life that move through, you know, rather than, you know, the ascension and... But it's a very powerful image that you're describing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a powerful image, but it also is, you know, it's just, I guess I'm just,
how do I want to describe this a little bit? I want to say, you're talking about powers, you're talking about cities, the inherent DNA, transfer of different cycles of power within the female body, right? And then the visual image. And what is it really that we're resistant to? I know it's not you and I, but what is it really that we are, as a culture, are resistant to in that opening?
Oh, that, you see, that's, you have all the good questions.
Well, they're inspired by you, so.
Yeah, but I feel that I usually only have one answer to most questions, and that's just like, well, ça dépend. That depends. You know, it depends how you look at it. But if you look at it as like, what is that, the yoni or the shakti, the power of shakti really about? And mostly it's kind of about uncertainty in lots of ways. Mm. It's unpredictable. I mean, there is cyclical wisdom, but a lot of what considered to be deeply feminine. And I make no apologies for using that word. I know a lot of my very radical friends think I shouldn't use the word feminine because they say it's a patriarchal concept and it's a construct. But what I'm talking about when I talk about the deep feminine is like the essence of that darkness, and it's the essence of time herself. I work a lot with the 10 wisdom goddesses, the Dasha Mahavidyas. And each one of those wisdom goddesses is almost like an aspect of feminine, another aspect. And it's so diverse that you need 10 goddesses. And there's such a sense that what we're scared of in some ways is the unpredictability of this and the fact that actually it's a very deep power that you can't really control. You can't control the power of life. Like, for example, you know, you may become pregnant, but there's no guarantee that that child is going to be born alive. It's not a dependable thing. We like to pretend like everything is very dependable, like you can have a career path and that you can make choices and that everything is under your control. And that's a very masculine process. It's la via positiva. You decide what you want and you go for it. But actually, it isn't like that. And everybody knows it's not like that, because at any minute you could be run over for under a bus, you know. In the last few months, I've lost some very dear friends, young people who unexpectedly have died from terrible diseases very rapidly, you know, active, amazing people who should be here, but you don't know what's going to happen. And that's kind of like the shakti of life. And I think there's a kind of really, God bless it, like a very kind of masculine, take a charge of it, matriarchal, take a hold of it, organize the shit out of it so that there's no doubt and there's no confusion and everything is moving upwards and there's endless economic progress. And that's clearly unsustainable. Do you know what I mean? Like, we only have one planet. We can't sustain that. But it's all part of the same package. And if you subscribe to that package, like if you get the right qualifications, and you make the right choices and you go to the right universities and work for the right corporations, then you'll have lots of money and everything in life will be under your control because you've got the right health insurance or you live in the right neighborhood and nothing bad will ever happen to you. And it's like, that's a sort of sense of trying to get hold of life, whereas we all know that it isn't like that. And I think part of the reason people are resistant to women's power and the deep feminine is that actually it puts us all in the same boat, you know? You, me, and the President of the United States, we're all in the same boat because, like, at any minute, you know, Shakti might just, you know, depart from us. Do you see what I mean? It's like this action.
No, I mean, that was exactly, I mean, and that's really it. Yeah. And you know what is this disturbing?
It's something that goes along with it.
And you know what's been a disturbing trend to me, from my eyes, and just some, not all, but some of the generation just behind me, is this desire to not have a period, to not go to eliminate the eliminate these cycles, eliminate this unknown, like to try and masculinize the feminine flow. And so many of those things are wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I are both allowed to sit here and have a podcast conversation with each other and write a book and teach and earn our own money and have our own homes. And you know, these things are, you know, these are wonderful. I can be educated, and, you know, that these things of being integrated into the patriarchal society as it stands are essential. But there's this little bit of disturbing trend of, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know if I'm right or not, of the sameness. And even talking about gender, the, you know, non-binary gender, people that don't identify with one particular gender is something that's very real right now. And so with all of this, and the depth of your work around the womb specifically and around the yoni specifically, I'd love to know your reflection on how that flows into every embodiment, every human embodiment.
Oh, you see, this is where it gets really interesting. Because if we live in a culture that wants to eradicate cyclical wisdom, basically what's going on with that? It's like, there's a sense that we can make choices about everything, and we can make decisions about everything, mm-hmm. and then we can kind of pin it all down so that actually you're not experiencing the ebbs and the flows of the tides of your hormones. And so you're basically, to me, a lot of disconnected from those flows by our culture's insistence that they're kind of shameful and inconvenient, and they're an impediment to progress, and they're an impediment to, you know, whatever education and career paths and all those things that people think matter. Then actually, that disconnection leads you to not even have. Is there people who never experience those things? If you go on the pill when you're very, very young, you don't get to experience like the natural ebbs and flows of your own particular cycle. Right. So that's one set of things. And how does that tie into like waves of what appears to be a really beautiful day, which I celebrate? You know, I've spent a lot of my life, you know, supporting the kind of freedom that allows us to make choices, express our own sexuality and our own desires in ways that we don't want to be judged for. What business is of yours when, you know, I choose to have a wife or a husband, you know? What business of yours is it to give me any judgments or grief about how I choose? Pronouns I choose. This is my business. And there's definitely, you know, how can you not fully support that sense of personal liberty? You know, that diversity and fluidity is to be welcomed. Right. And if there's such a sense of kind of really deep grief and distress about the presence of physical cycles that are deeply feminine, then there's something quite strange going on sometimes. And it's very hard to know how these things are connected or disconnected. I mean, and I'm not in a position to like offer really fully information about them. What I see is that most of my work is with women who grew up as girls. So there is a need, I feel, to really support the experiences of women who grew up as girls. Because many things happen to girls that don't happen to boys. There's all kinds of things that can happen. So a lot of the work that I do around menstruation, around the onset of menstruation, and around the suffering that women throughout their lives, right through to menopause, can have because of something that happened around the shame that was loaded upon them when they first began to bleed. And there's so much work to be done around that most of my work focuses on that, really. Mostly I see women who grew up as girls, who identify as women, and who are trying to make peace with their first bleed and with all the shame that's been surrounding that. And that's kind of where I am. Like, I spend a lot of time with blood and with humans that bleed and humans that have uteruses and humans that menstruated. And so I'm up to my eyes in blood. So it's not a very good person to give you a view after that. Because what I see is that that blood and the shame that we have around that blood is like a whole, I've got a whole of my own to deal with this little set of circles. And so, but like I have, you know, at a personal level, in terms of the expression of my own sexuality and the love for liberty and freedom that I have, you know, I fully welcome all of this, diversity, you know, so that's welcome. And I feel that there's a lot of conversations that need to be had, and we can't have them sometimes unless people have done their own or language around women and their blood, really. It's just like, and then around how we make peace with that when we come to menopause and all of that. So I don't know if that's a really helpful answer, but
no, it was really, it was a, it's a great,
that we can't really get yet.
I think it's cool. To this idea of the personal individual cycle and the personal individual exploration of that, and this healing of this long trajectory of growing up as a girl in the culture as it is now, that can only benefit everyone. I want to switch gears quick to the beautiful yantras that you include in your book. I've been really experiencing super effects just from working with them a little bit, and I'm curious about that as something that could be a window in for this kind of bridging of the gap. Do you get what I'm getting at? So, because they're so feminine, right? They're so rooted in the feminine, but the experience of them is not only for me.
Yeah, I mean, it might be useful for some of the. It's like a geometric form that encases and embodies the energy of a particular, in these cases, particular goddesses of the 10 wisdom goddesses. Mm-hmm. And so rather than a mandala being circular, the yantras usually have a beautiful square form with four gates on each side of the square. And you enter in very delicately and with beautiful awareness with your eyes, or if you're creating a yantra, you start from the outside and you work in. To connect with this energy and of the goddess. And I need to give credit where it's due. All of the yantras in Yoni Shakti were painted by my husband, Nirlipta Thule. It's 7 years for him to paint them. And each yantra in the book is about the size of a page, but actually in our yoga studio at home, they're a good, I mean, I've got my arms wide open here. I don't know how many, they're like 3-4 foot across, square. So, and they're very powerful, and they took 7 years to paint their oil on linen and their traditional structures, but he's intuited certain colorways and coloring system. And I think that many people find them very powerful and moving, and they don't know why, they just like gaze at them. And you're drawn into these, like these little worlds of the powers of God. And I just think that it's a beautiful way to meditate because it's not really very cognitive. It's not verbal. They're very visual entities. And when you look into them, you kind of go into them. I mean, the ones we have at home are huge. Like when you look at them, they're wider than your shoulders. So you're inside them. But looking at the ones in the book, and we made them into a little set of cards as well, so you can look at them individually and carry them with you. And I just think they actually genuinely, in those visual forms, they encase power. They kind of they clothe the body of the goddess and her energies. They're so, I think they're very, in some ways, very accessible, even though they look quite esoteric. You know, it's sort of, it's not really esoteric. Direct. It's almost like you're in direct communication with that form of energy. So with the 10 wisdom goddesses, it's with the 10 different aspects of femininity, that which is how I see it. Not everybody sees them that way.
They're very, very beautiful tool, and I just think I shared one with a friend of mine, and you know, I didn't say anything about it. And I think it was kind of a cool
it was kind of a cool, a seduction, but without being leading into anything. Right? So I felt there was a seductive energy to it. And this is, you know, again, back to sexuality. And, you know, I'm in the States, so, you know, we have the worst, history around sexual repression. We don't, you know, it's no, by any means, it's not France or, you know, it's just so I think that, you know, this, the connection of the power of the sexual energy of the feminine and this unknown thing of the yoni and this unpredictability, there's something nice I felt like in that, in the geometry, that in like that just kind of opened that space without needing it to be, you know, consummated per se, but it kind of invited this gentleman into that area without any, you know, flirtation or something like that. That was the energy that I just felt shift when I shared that with him. So I guess I just was, you know, it's interesting. I didn't realize that. I think I read it in there. I didn't realize it was your husband that had painted them. So I love that. That's part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And he painted the antlers, but there's also in the book, and on the set of the, we did a little deck of cards with them. Each one has a figure as well. So they appear as a human sort of figure as in different forms, and they're very powerfully naive drawings that they're modeled on the Madhubani folk art, which is a folk art of women in Bihar in northeast India, and which is the matrilineal line of my husband. So his maternal line comes from that part of India. Well, so it was a really nice connection. So I think the two things are quite different. Like you get all the stories about the goddess, then you get the yantras, which are these beautiful colored geometrical shapes, and then you get these really cool, some of them are quite scary, you know, like the Tara and the Kali and the Chinnamaster are very fierce. They're like cutting off heads and their own heads sometimes and holding very fierce weapons, but they're very powerful symbols. And when I share about them, I often do opportunities to connect them. I honestly feel that these presences, whether they're in the yantra or in these little images of these very fierce-looking ladies, that they're real, you know, kick-ass women, that they were real. They were legendary. You know, wow. They were, like, so powerful. Tara was a... And I just, I mean, I literally have just finished now. We're working in this beautiful meditation center in the Mulan Dashav in the Dordogne, and the new temple that they built, or the new meditation hall, is the Tara Hall. And there's a beautiful Buddhist image of green Tara. We were just chanting Tara there. But this Hindu tantric Tara, she's got weapons, you know. She has an axe, she has scissors. She has, you know, she's a powerful force to disentangle us from delusion and guide us. And I think that energy is very tangible. And when I introduce them and work with them, the way that the book came through me was actually that they were visitations. These were like very powerful entities or presences, like the presence of different aspects of femininity demanding to be seen. So it's great for people to be looking at these yantras, reading these stories, and looking at these scary drawings, because it's every aspect of femininity is demanding, not just like the sexy 16-year-old, but like the old crone and the troublesome middle-aged lady who just tells you it like it is. All of these ones are aspects of femininity. The wild poet who really, you know, tells you the truth. So there's truth speaking and sweetness and generosity and bad tempered fierceness, and all of that is an aspect of the deep feminine, and that's why people are scared of it, because it's like it's all of those things. It's not just, you know, a sweet and charming, fertile, sexy Aphrodite type goddess. There's nine others. They're all on her team.
Right. Well, so I want to talk about this one other thing that you've done, and I don't think it was, I think it was your retelling of someone else's retelling, about yoga, the yoga, the development of yoga. And I do my book, I'm traveling and I, how you tell the story of the, I don't remember which goddess it was or what the character was, but she's just stretching her body and resting over rocks and, you know, which would be like a bridge pose or, you know, doing all these stretches and that her lover is watching her through the, can you tell that a little bit? I love this reimagine of where wisdom comes from.
Special. Yeah. So Angela Farmer is now 80 years old. Angela Farmer is an exquisitely powerful yoga called the Feminine Unfolding. And she lives in Lesbos in a goddess temple, as far as I'm concerned, that's where it is. And she was for a very long time a top student of Iyengar's. So she was like an international Iyengar yoga person. Anyway, and all kinds of things happened to her. And she told me this story of the, she says that it's Parvati who invented yoga. Because there's a story of how Shiva invented yoga. That's the usual story, is that Shiva tells all of the stories and secrets of yoga to Parvati. And the story is that Parvati falls asleep. And that instead of Parvati hearing it, then Matsya hears it, a fish in the river, and it's and Shiva turns Matsya into Matsyendranath, the great yogi, and that's how the lineage of yoga begins. But Angela Farmer says, oh no, that's not the case at all. She says exactly as you remember, that she says it was a natural unfoldment in the delight and joy that the goddess Parvati, Shiva's wife, has living at the top of Mount Kailash or in their paradisical home. And she's just delightfully taking care of herself, self-care. You know, it's a woman's self-care practice. She's moving and breathing and stretching and twisting and, you know, and she's observed. And so the story is that Shiva he's prohibited from coming to her. She says, this is my private time. And, you know, you Shivaji, you need to go away and go meditate somewhere. But this is my secret time. And I imagine her in some phenomenal bath, you know, with the just loads of, anyway, beautiful tropical stuff and sandalwood paste, and she's anointing herself. But the point is, he gets to see her and he's fascinated by all the moves and the breathing. And so he goes away and meditates on it and he codifies it and he turns it into a system, because that's what, it's a very masculine thing to do with this. So he turns everything that she's done out of her natural intuitive self-care program and movements into a system. And then all of Shiva's devotees, his ganas, and he's known for having some pretty wild, you know, gangster type followers. He'll take anyone, you know. So they all come to him in the jungle and they see him practicing. And they're like, oh, Shivaji, you must tell us how to practice this stuff. This is amazing. He goes, no, this is yoga and this is my private thing and I'm not going to train anyone. But anyway, they keep on at him until one day he says, well, look, bring your yoga mats, come in the morning early. And that he lines them all up and he starts training them, you know, inhale up, exhale down, right foot back, left foot back. And when Angela Farmer told me the story, as a good ex-Iyengar practitioner of these straight arms, like little soldiers, you know, like in the military, like a drill. And so Shiva drills all of his followers, and then at the end, graduate, like they've been at some yoga TTC, a yoga teacher training course, and he graduates them and he sends them out into the world. He says, you can set up the Yoga Institute of, you know, Albuquerque, and you can set up the yoga school of Colorado, and you can go and run the yoga school of Delhi, and you people over there can run the New York City Academy of Yoga Science and Arts or whatever it is. So he sends them all out, and then they all run, you know, and you know what happens. The story is that yoga ends up as this commodified military practice that everybody does in lines, which it was never like that anywhere. It was always individuals teaching other individuals. Anyway, so one day Parvati looks down from her lovely bathroom as she's doing her stretches and she's like, oh my God, what happened? You know, she just laughs at them all because it's so far removed from her own feminine unfolding practice, which is what Angela Farmer teaches, that she doesn't even recognize it and she just laughs at them all. So yeah, I love that story. So yes,
it really encapsulates it encapsulates kind of where we started, you know, this conversation in the heat and the heart of it, which is this, the unpredictability and the, you know, that wildness, that openness, that birth and death and blood, that flow, that sensuality, that that we are working with teachers like you to reconnect with that those cities, and to be able to use them properly and successfully, you know, in our lives and in our world, to the benefit of the whole. And so I'm just so super, yeah, super grateful for your book, and I'm so happy to have gotten a chance to connect with you. And I look forward to meeting you sometime in person and maybe getting to one of your trainings. I encourage everybody to grab a copy of Yoni Shakti and go to yonishakti.co and look for any events where Uma might be in your area, and go meet her, study with her. And thank you so much, Uma.
I see.